everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, you betcha. And this is number 80. Good Story, episode 80. And we're going to talk about Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman.
Talk about a book where there's traces of one reality, but you kind of might have to dig to find them.
Oh, man. Yeah. We are recording this on April Fool's Day.
Oh,
which
right.
which is a good day to talk about this book. I laughed out loud several times. This is the second time I've read it. Excuse me. And it is just so funny. It is a hilarious book.
I don't know how they did it, but it is so funny. And, well, of course, both these authors are funny on their own.
Yes, they are.
So together, they just somehow did this seamless melding. And I also laughed out loud several times. And I will say this, two times, come on. Oh, wait, I forgot, you don't reread, really.
Not often. Well, I always reread these.
Just thinking, don't sound defensive. It's okay, Scott.
Oh, good. Because I know I was last time we were talking about that, or when I brought that up, and I was like, okay, do I reread? I thought, and I said, yeah, I usually do not, but.
And this book, I don't keep track of how many times I read a book, but I've read it plenty of times. So my guess would be 5 or 6 times, because I can tell you whole sections of the book. I can't quote the dialogue exactly, but when I hit it, it's like, oh yeah, hitting that section of road that you love to drive on. You know,
like
it so it. Well.
Yep. Well, like cool.
The nursing home, or not nursing home, the maternity hospital.
Oh my gosh.
That's turned into the paintball executive.
Oh, how fun it would have been to hear those conversations if they had just recorded it all. I'm sure, you know, I can only imagine what was left on the table.
Yeah, because when these two, there's a bit in the back of the book, where they talk about how they wrote it. And this was back in the day when I guess they had fax machines. And they were trying to send each other stuff, but it really wouldn't work. So they'd have to just call each other up and go, I just wrote something really good. And then they'd read it to each other. And then they'd go racing away to get to the next good bit before the other guy. That had to add to the synergy of just the manic nature of some of these scenes. Because some of these things are just, they just don't quit on so many levels. You know, what's happening is hilarious. The thoughts everybody's having are hilarious. The commentary that's being made by the narrator is hilarious. The unspoken narrator, third person narrator. And yet it's also, as with both of these authors, using the humor, it's also making serious points about things.
Yeah, I think it is too. So in the past we've done a Neil Gaiman book, right?
Yep.
And we've done a Terry Pratchett. We did Hogfather.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, I noticed I did a SFF Audio new releases, and one of the new releases was Discworld number 40. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Wow. No. Now, do you keep up with those at all?
No, well, the Discworld, he has several series within the Discworld universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones I like are the ones with the three witches and the ones with Death as a main character. And he may have written some with Death as a main character, but my favorites are the three witches. And he hasn't done any of those for a while. And I've tried the other ones with there's some with some of the soldiers in Ankh-Morpork. I guess that's how you say it, the main town.
Yeah, yeah.
And then standalone type books. And I keep trying them, and I don't know what the dynamic is. It's different.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. And it's also interesting that, Neil Gaiman has written about Death in Sandman.
Oh, and I haven't ever...
And Death is a character in Sandman. She's a kind of a very young female.
Huh.
And, Terry Pratchett writes about Death in Discworld, and Death is in this book.
Yes, and death is not as humorous in this book as usually.
Right, right.
Well, you've got the other Horsemen of the Apocalypse, so, you know, it's a working trip for death.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
But yeah, usually in Terry Pratchett's books, death is trying to understand people a little better. So he's doing things like having a cat, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is humorous.
Right. So the book is about the apocalypse. The whole title is, in fact, let's get the cover here.
I know.
Because I want to get it just right. Oh, my ebook doesn't have a nice cover.
Okay, let's
hold on
see.
A second here. I've got it here. It is called Good Omens, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter Witch. It was published in 1990. Okay. So it starts with the book of Genesis.
I just love it. It's from the point of view of the angel who drives out Adam and Eve and the serpent who are having a conversation.
Exactly. Yeah, it starts, "It was a nice day." All the days had been nice. There had been rather more than seven of them so far, and rain hadn't been invented yet. But clouds massing east of Eden suggested that the first thunderstorm was on its way, and it was going to be a big one. I love that. And so we're introduced immediately to an angel named Aziraphale and a demon named Crowley.
Well, his name then is Crowley.
That's right. That's right.
He thought he might change it, though. Didn't like the sound.
That's right. Yeah, it says, although he, yeah, his name is Crowley, although he was thinking of changing it now, Crowley, he decided, was not him.
Well,
so,
go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I love it because you immediately get the idea of the book because the angel's like, "I'm sorry, what were you saying?" And the serpent says, "I said that one went down like a lead balloon." Well, I think it was a bit of an overreaction, to be honest, said the angel. First offense and everything.
That is funny, yeah.
So it's already, you've got that idea of there is something going on, but everybody involved doesn't really understand it. You know?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. We have the bosses that never actually make an appearance themselves.
Right.
Running things. And the angels and the demons are just as perplexed by it all as humans are. Although the humans don't really notice most of it.
Right.
And so these characters, Aziraphale and Crowley, are there throughout all of human history, which is about 4,000 years or something like that, I think they say. And the book is about the apocalypse, the birth of the son of Satan.
And the Antichrist.
And the end times, exactly. And Aziraphale and Crowley decide that maybe the end times is kind of a bummer because they don't want it to end. They're enjoying themselves. So they actually team up. This angel and this demon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is, like we said, a comedy.
Yeah. And I like the way that basically they're compared to spies. Because at the time this was written, the Cold War was still going on, really, essentially, I guess, or had been.
Sure.
It's kind of, they're compared to, you know, they've both been at the outpost so long, they've decided they have to kind of work together to make things work at all. So they kind of allow each other certain things and then they kind of get together and they're the only people like them they know. And
And I love that dynamic, you know, and it didn't, you know, if we're looking for, you know, serious points being made in satire, it's almost like, you know, we've got these countries that, you know, we're constantly warring us humans. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the soldiers really have no clue why it is they're fighting in the first place.
Right.
And, they sure could end up being friends, but it's the people that are up at the top that are fighting. And
well, it's like that story of the World War One Christmas Eve when the Germans and the British in the trenches, and they come out and in the no man's land, they have their Christmas together.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
But I did want to say, I've never really noticed this before. I was looking for the complete title in my, cause I have a print book.
Mm-hmm.
And before the copyright and everything, it has caveat, Bringing about Armageddon can be dangerous. Do not attempt it in your own home. And that's in bold type. And then the foreword is, the authors would like to join the Demon Crowley in dedicating this book to the memory of G.K. Chesterton, a man who knew what was going on.
Oh, that's nice. Like,
whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, because talk about somebody who made points by turning things upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I like that a lot. I like that very much. That's really
neat. These guys have got it going on, these two guys. So smart.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure.
Yeah, so it jumps ahead from there. And they use all the things that you traditionally expect, like the voice of God and, you know, evil and good are working against each other. And there's this idea that everybody kind of knows about. There's this ineffable plan that God has that everything will work together in the end. But they're both working, both sides are working toward the final conflict because they feel like that's the point and that's where they're going to win. Good will win or evil will win.
And they say it's not set, even though the book says it's set. They're saying, no, it's not set.
Yeah. Well, the evil side's like, why would we even try otherwise?
Why would we even try if we knew we were going to fail? Exactly.
And so when it begins, after the foreword, it begins 11 years ago. And that's when the Antichrist is born and Aziraphale and Crowley figure out, we kind of like it here. Crowley's
I'm laughing because the moment you said he was born, I mean, that is some hilarious stuff. Oh, my goodness. There are these nuns, these satanic nuns.
The chattering
incompetent
order.
Satanic nuns. Oh, my gosh.
They're you know. British. It's so chattering.
And later on, you know, they go to the site of where this these nuns lived. And they said, why isn't there a sign? Or is you know, they couldn't find it or something. And he said, where's the sign? And why doesn't it say, you know, these incompetent nuns used to live here or something like that?
A historical marker.
Historical marker. That's exactly right. Because it is their job to take the son of Satan, who has cute toesy woesies.
Because he's a little human baby.
He's a little human baby, blonde. And their job was to place the baby with the family in order, you know, in other words, they were going to switch the kids so that this son of Satan would be raised by a family.
By an American family.
By an American family, right.
Because everybody knows the apocalypse is going to start in America or because of
and
America.
And I loved their references to the Omen. The Omen movies, Omen movies.
You could name him Damien.
Yeah, you could name him Damien. And then they talked about giving him a tricycle.
Yeah.
And there was also a hellhound a little bit later.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I've never seen the Omen movies. So
yeah. Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize that.
The original
that
one
was
with Gregory Peck. That was a good movie.
Okay.
But yeah, I saw all three of them when I was young. It probably scarred me for life.
Of course.
But that's why. That's how I know Sam Neill. I mean, I still can't see him without thinking Damien.
Oh, was he the grown-up Damien?
Yeah, he was in three. Yeah.
Okay.
Damien Thorne. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, and the thing is that scene in the hospital when they're, in fact, even on the way there, they're setting up so much stuff to make that helps you kind of just to see the tone of the book. Like when Crowley's on his way to meet these demons, he doesn't know why, but he's been told, and he has his 1926 Bentley that he loves. Mm. And he gets on this one motorway that just, you know, drives everyone to distraction. He's like, it was one of his best pieces of work. All of those people so frustrated. And this is in the shape of the something sigil or sigil. And so it's just sending out destruction wherever it goes. And you're just like,
wow.
That's why those freeways are like that.
Yeah. I mean, and that's kind of, a minor theme that came up several times in the book was this kind of emanation of evil or emanation of good. You know, ripples of it, like, you know, something would happen. Like Aziraphale, the angel, he had a much harder time bringing people into the good than Crowley had with the evil.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Crowley would do was something that would just send ripples of evil everywhere, you know, like phone salespeople or... This traffic thing that you're talking about, not only is it like a prayer wheel, but you know, it's frustrating and makes people angry. Oh. And then as they're angry, this emanates evil, and it's like a, you know, he'll stand there in satisfaction when he does something like that. And because the, you know, he knows that it's, there's going to be ripples, and that's going to affect this and that's going to affect that. And he's like, all right, well, that's a good one.
And then it earned him a commendation.
Yeah, exactly.
The other demons never understand this. They understand things like, I've turned a clergyman and he'll be ours in 5 years. And
right,
yeah. Crowley's like, listen to what I did. And he's telling something like this. And they're like, and?
And?
So, and he's like, oh, they never get it.
He's like, hundreds of people. Yeah.
So,
and
yeah,
and Aziraphale, the good one, is just like those other demons, you know, working on one person at a time, trying to, you know, bring this person along and all that stuff. And
yeah, Zira feels hopelessly old fashioned, except that when it comes down to it, he does what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But yep. As a general personality trait, you know, he loves classical music. He's 50 years behind the times on what's hip and what isn't. Loves, you know, has an old bookstore and he just stay there forever.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. He collects, you know, books.
Yeah,
he's not hip because good isn't hip.
That's right. That's right.
Right. It can't be, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but that is an important theme, because they're weaving these themes through here that are kind of big truths of just about living, and everybody knows them. And that's what makes it so funny. But, you know, when you look at it as Catholics, you go, yep, intentions matter. And if you do something nice with a terrible feeling, kind of negates it from your point of view.
Yeah, sure enough.
You know, it's not going down on your side of the scorecard. Or if you put up with something awful, but you've got it for the best of intentions. Intentions are an important part of this book, really.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's also kind of like P.G. Wodehouse in a way, in that these terrible tangles everything gets into. And that's part of the humor. And that thing about the babies is, there wind up being three babies. There's a local family that's having a baby there at the same time as the American diplomat has been skillfully managed so that the wife happens to be there so that they can bring the other baby, the Antichrist baby, in and change it. And these nuns are hopelessly incompetent. So, of course, the Antichrist goes home with the normal English family.
Yeah.
English baby goes home with the American. No, some baby, the American baby, I guess, gets taken away by the demons, and they go, well, we don't want to talk about what happens to it. Hey, let's say it gets adopted by some people and goes to live a normal life. It has a pretty good life. We like your story. Let's go with that one. And you're like, oh, no. And then later on, they're talking about some big bully, and they go, because he was adopted, and they go, see, you were right. And you just go, oh, thank you.
I love that.
Yeah, love but it's that. But just the whole comic sequence of the babies getting mixed up and everybody misunderstanding each other because of winks and nods and the talking across purposes, and
exactly, it's yeah,
so funny.
Right. So out of the end of that is, they think that the Antichrist is a kid who is not the Antichrist. And the demon and the angel and the people that were placed there permanently, neither of them know that it's not. So they're fighting over the Antichrist. There's like a gardener that's always teaching him good, and this nanny that's always teaching him bad.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of having this tug of war, because they figure, well, the boy is human, so they're trying to influence how he's going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, one with the hope of stopping the apocalypse and one with the hope of making it happen. So then there's this children's party. This 11-year-old, you know, he's having his 11th birthday, and I'm not sure what the significance of 11 is.
That's when his hellhound shows up.
Right, yeah. So,
that's just when,
right,
it happens.
So hell calls up Crowley and says, we're about to send the hellhound. So Crowley and Aziraphale both make sure that they're present on the birthday. One of them doing party tricks. And the hellhound never shows up.
Yeah, and the hellhound is important because whatever form he takes will show the innermost, be like a picture of the innermost heart of the Antichrist.
Hmm.
And in the meantime, the Antichrist has been left to grow up as a perfectly normal kid out in the countryside. And he's, when you see him with his buddies, you know, he is a normal kid, but he's the one who thinks up the best ideas. He's, you know, the leader of their little group and the instigator of everything. And then when the hellhound shows up, that's where I always laugh out loud. The hellhound's like, it was his master's, capital M voice. And mm-hmm. he's like, oh, I'm going to get a dog for my birthday. And he's listening like, this is what I'll be like. And his eyes are glowing red and he's huge and slavering. And he goes, he'll be a proper dog, you know, with one ear that sticks up and a little short guy and a kind of a mongrel. And he gives his pop of a large dog being displaced by a very small mongrelly looking dog.
Oh, right.
And it's kind of a tribute in a sense also to that idea that your outer not just the nurturing thing, that if you're left alone, you can find what you're really like, but that idea that your outer appearance kind of forms who you are too, or at least how you think of yourself. Because by the end of the book, the hellhound knows the apocalypse is coming and he's pretty ticked off because he almost had down how to get even with that cat down at the end of the road. He's pretty sure this next plan was going to work. Now he's never going to get to try it out.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Well, I just hadn't thought about it, but
It sure is. Yeah. Yeah. But it changes the hellhound's personality, you know, his outward appearance. Yeah. And, that just reminds me of, Father Barron, you know, I'm subscribed to his Lenten thing that he sends through. Mm-hmm. And he had one on, you know, body posture and things during prayer and stuff. And that's interesting, too.
I know. I realized I can't remember if I heard that one. I like one or two behind because I've been listening to C.S. Lewis. So I'm having trouble fitting these things in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's so much, isn't there? I mean,
I know.
Well, you can find stuff to follow everywhere.
I know. And so you kind of have to just go, well, for right now, I'm going to listen to this. But I think I might have heard that or read something recently because I was going, I had some other realization about that, you know, our, sorry, everyone, huge divergence here. But our souls and our bodies are intricately attached. Everybody likes to think of them like they're completely separate.
Mm.
And so your outward posture does influence how you think and feel. And it's like even taking these dance lessons my husband and I are taking. He said he danced with the instructor and we were practicing in the living room. And she's like, pick your head up and look at your partner because that makes your whole posture straighten up and it changes how you feel about what you're doing.
Hmm.
And because I had been saying, wow, you're leading so well, you know, I can feel where you're moving me. And he's like, oh, she said this. And I was like, I really should be kneeling when I pray.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah,
at least certain kinds of prayer.
Exactly. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but it ties right in to the same thing. You know, this it's the same kind of root or however.
Mm-hmm. One part of us influences the other part because it's all connected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is a Catholic thing, but, you know, some planner type people, I can't even remember the name of some of them, but they're like, if you want to be something, you know, start to act that way.
Yeah. And that kind of is, I don't know if it's an essentially Catholic thing, but I've seen that many people say that, saints and, you know, doctors of the church and stuff.
Yeah.
And that idea that, well, and it's that idea that I remember hearing a study that if you smile, it kind of influences your brain somehow, and eventually you start feeling better.
Yeah.
And I started doing that, and I went, oh my gosh, I feel better today. Because I was feeling really down, but instead I, you know, went around acting like I wasn't. And that's also that kind of idea that if you, it's kind of an older idea, but I think it's the idea that just work at something. Gradually acquire it. We all want to get everything and do everything instantly.
Yeah, and some things are worth the effort, and some things, you know, take effort.
You know, a lot of people say, naturally,
right?
Yeah, go ahead.
What's worth doing takes effort. you know, if,
yeah,
there was another quote that came through about, you know, from John Paul II, who said, you know, loving people is difficult. It's not easy. He said he would be remiss if he didn't pass that on.
No kidding.
You know, so he's, and, I'm pretty sure there's a Bible verse that talks about, you know, what good is it to love your friends, you know,
when you can, from Jesus.
Okay. Yeah, when you love your enemies, loving your enemies is much more difficult, you know? So in other words, you know, there are people that take effort.
Yeah. He's like, even the pagans do that. What's the point?
Exactly.
It's like, do it anyway. And that's, and what's interesting is if you go on doing that, eventually it changes you. It doesn't mean that you love to do the hard things, but what it means is you understand more about yourself and about what you're doing, and you start to understand the people you're working with more who maybe you didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's an interesting dynamic, but it takes a while, and it kind of goes back to, in a sense, you know, that used to be the way our culture was, and then they started going, well, if it doesn't feel good, don't do it, or you shouldn't force yourself to do stuff you hate because that's not natural to you, and... But if we didn't do that, we'd never get anywhere. I mean, going to the moon wasn't easy.
Wow, that is so true. Yeah.
You know, and there had to be parts of it that people just hated.
Right, right.
You know, I remember talking to my priest one time and going, well, I just hate this, you know, ministry I'm helping with. And he's like, do you think there aren't parts of my job that I just hate? And there are things that people see and they're nice things. He goes, but, you know, eventually you get used to it and you don't hate it so much. And he goes, and then it's good for you too. And I went, oh, damn it. Okay.
Fine then, yeah.
Yeah. Fine. And I went, stomp out to my room.
yeah, and no question.
What's kind of interesting about this book is whether or not people know what the ineffable plan is or what they think it is, they're all trying to do the best they can. They're all trying to either manage the situation or handle whatever's been given to them. Or, you know, work things out for the best as they see it. Everybody's scrambling around trying to do that. And in the end, it all comes out. But it's because everybody had to go do something they didn't want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except for the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They were pretty happy about what they were doing.
Right, right. Yeah, and they one of the things that I highlighted, Crowley and Aziraphale were talking about God's plan.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, doing things right and that kind of stuff. And Crowley was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, how did he says, hang on, that only works if you start everyone off equal, okay? You can't start someone off in a muddy shack in the middle of a war zone and expect them to do as well as someone born in a castle. Ah, Aziraphale had said, that's the good bit. The lower you start, the more opportunities you have.
Yeah.
Crowley had said, that's lunatic. No, said Aziraphale, it's ineffable.
Yeah. Yeah. It was around 10:20 when they were having this talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, that and the free will.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole book essentially is about free will. What does it mean to be a human being? And what did I write down? And the ineffable plan. And here's what I thought was hilarious is, I remember when they were changing the language for the liturgy and there was all this fluff, kerfluffle over everything.
Sure.
And the bishops were in, the American bishops anyway, were in two camps. And one was saying, we need to make, the Vatican told us, we've got to make the language match more what the Latin has been saying. And then there was the other kind, which had made everything, you know, I'm just going to say, dumbed down. Very simple after Vatican II. So you lost some of the subtleties and richness of the language. And they were saying, well, the people aren't going to understand these things. Who's going to understand the word ineffable? And every Catholic like me went, have you never read Good Omens? What's wrong with you? That word's only used about 50 times.
Yeah, I was going to say, this has the record for the use of that word in a book.
Yeah.
It's got to.
Yeah.
Ineffable, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and ineffable, of course, means that there are no F's.
No what?
F's. No F's in this. I'm just joking.
Oh. I was going, what?
Yeah, inability to use F's. Right.
Got it. I'm slow this morning. I'm sorry. Everybody else is like, wow, she is not as smart as we thought. But Scott is funnier than we thought. Oh, Scott's pretty funny.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you are.
Oh, stop.
Oh, I won't. I did like also that Crowley would do stuff and he'd always go, you know, being a demon, of course, was supposed to mean you had no free will, but you couldn't hang around humans for very long without learning a thing or two.
Oh, yeah.
And Crowley is always making these little side comments or side thoughts about human beings and what they're capable of that demons and possibly angels, because it's angels, demons are just fallen angels anyway, can't believe or can't achieve, because he's talking about, you know, some of the things people could do. And I had that marked and I don't know if I've got it to hand, where he was saying that he, you know, he'd oh, that was right before the bit you were talking about. And he's talking about, they've got what we lack. They've got imagination and electricity, of course. And so he says he'd gotten a commendation for the Spanish Inquisition. He had been in Spain then, mainly hanging around cantinas in the nicer parts, and hadn't even known about it until the commendation arrived. He'd gone to have a look and had come back and got drunk for a week. And then just when you'd think they were more malignant than ever hell could be, they could occasionally show more grace than heaven ever dreamed of. Often the same individual was involved. It was this free will thing, of course. It was a bugger.
I love that, yeah.
And that's, of course, the beauty of the book is that since the Antichrist is allowed to grow up without any outside meddling, he is a human being with free will. And so when the crisis point comes, it's a very interesting thing that I wouldn't have thought about if we weren't going to talk about this book. But you think of Armageddon and the Antichrist and hell, of course, and you think of hatred. And because we, you know, hell is coldly opposed to us. They don't care about us one way or the other. They just hate us and they want to make God furious or sorry or something. And so the funny thing to me is that the Armageddon is coming because of love. Because of Adam's great love, and of course the fact that he's named Adam, first man.
Yeah, yeah.
But it can be destructive as a force as hate if it's completely focused on what you want instead of the good of the other people around you. And that's what brings them to this crisis point. He loves the world. He loves the earth. And he has that sudden realization of, you know, it should be all pirates and cowboys and Indians and stuff. And then you grow up, because he's been reading all these nut bar magazines about, and you find out it's about, well, I guess the nut bar magazines don't have so much of this, but he's like, you find out it's about the whales are all dying and the rainforests are gone and this and that, and they've ruined everything. I'm going to fix it.
Yep.
And, but what saves him and us and everybody is his love for his and his friends' love for him and his love for his friends. Just knowing it, just looking at them and seeing them cowering in a corner when he's like, I'm going to command you.
Yeah.
And they all look at him and he's like, wait, I didn't mean it. Because he realizes the full picture at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. And Adam is the Antichrist. I don't know if we said that.
Just I didn't say that.
Just to make sure that, you know.
Yeah, no, I didn't say that.
Whoever
right.
might be doing this. Yeah. So it's the 11-year-old Antichrist.
Right.
Yep. With his buddies. But yeah. Yeah. You know, one other thing that I wanted to say as well about the free will thing is that that's something that I still have not been able to understand is Christianity without the concept of free will. And I know some sects of Christianity really don't believe in free will, but it just doesn't make any sense to me. I haven't been able to get my mind around that. It seems like that is absolutely necessary. I just can't. Yeah. I just don't understand the philosophy.
No,
but
I mean,
free will is so important throughout this whole book, and it's mentioned several times.
Yeah. Well, and how can you? It does boggle the mind. Christ's entire life showed free will. I mean, right down to the struggle in the garden. Not my will, but your, you know, take this cup from me, please, but not my will, but yours. He's giving up his will.
Yeah.
At the end, you know, it is done. It took me until seeing the Passion of the Christ and then going back and rereading that section in all the Gospels of understanding that it is done didn't mean, and I'm dying. He gave up his spirit. He deliberately did that. It was his choice. I mean, people who don't believe in free will don't understand people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they want an easier way. And if there was an easier way, we would be puppets. There's no love in that.
Right, right. And it seems to me that if we were puppets, you know, you could have constructed everything a whole lot differently.
We'd be
happy. And why wouldn't you? Exactly. You know, if we're puppets anyway, why not make it differently?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right. And that's that idea of the truest definition of love, which is hard for us to understand because we want to box it in. And so we can understand it better. But it's, if you, it's that old corny saying, I guess corny because it's so true, is if you love something, you have to set it free. And if it comes back, then it's yours. And if it doesn't, it wasn't ever yours. Mm. I mean, that's that beauty of God's, you know, how, that's why we have such a hard time understanding him. That's not how we would do it necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why people like Labradors so much. They love you so much.
Mm-hmm.
But we had one. I've never had dogs like that. We always had Bull Mastiffs, which are a bit more independent. And they love you, but you know, they love the whole family. And you're not the end all and be all, and that's okay. But so we had this dog and it loved me so much and it was pretty suffocating, you know, to be followed around by this dog that just loved me all the time. And would I just pet it and it would just lick me. And I was, by the end of his life, you know, I loved him fine, but it was always kind of like, could you just back off some? And that, again, that's an inadequate description, but.
No, you know. That's funny. And just as another aside, I was thinking about you the other day as I was driving along and my dog put her head out the window and just ears flapping away. I just thought of something that you told me once. You said there is nothing like a good dog.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you know, Julie was so right and I need to tell her.
Oh,
because, you know, you just have that moment of joy. Just, you know, this dog is experiencing pure joy sitting there next to me, just sticking her head out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it changes your life a little bit. It makes you, I don't know, it affects you.
It's such a wonderful example of living in the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they understand the past and they understand the future in a sense. You know, they know that at this time of the day, the food's going to happen. Well, you know, oh, you walked by that door.
Yeah.
The leash is out. You just put your different shoes on. So they understand the hope for the future, but it's all so much around the moment. And we were realizing that because we went out of town this weekend and we had the day without the dogs and we kind of felt like, oh, we're not on their routine. Okay. And I got them from the vet and they're running around. And last night, Tom said, oh, they feel so good because it's not the vet. And I said, I don't think they know exactly why they feel so good. They just know I feel so great right now because it's the moment they're
in.
Yeah. And so we kind of look at them some and go, we need to be more in the moment like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good life lesson. It really is. It's like, you know, is this other stuff so important? You know, that's what it makes you think about.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're really enjoying our dog very much.
She sounds like a great dog.
Yeah. She's good.
Maybe that's why I liked the Hellhound so much, because it just embraced the human life or the canine life with Adam's idea of how a dog would be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was funny.
It was. It was.
And even things that aren't funny, well, they're written funny. But it's harder to laugh at things like famine, death, or war.
Oh, my goodness.
And they replaced pestilence with pollution because they're like, you know, disease has been largely conquered. So pollution is the other big thing now.
Yeah.
And then death. As they go around, you're laughing because you see the way that they're affecting things, their personal missions in the world. but it's not funny because they're also pointing out the things that we do to ourselves and to each other. Like famine was particularly painful to me.
Mm-hmm.
Watching people starve themselves literally to death for fashion and,
yeah, yeah.
So they were also kind of pointing that stuff out about people too, how stupid that is.
Right. Yeah. It's worth saying, you know, that had Gaiman all over it. And I think in that thing, it actually said, you know, the four horsemen were, you know, motorcycle riders and the, let's see, wasn't it War? War was female.
Mm-hmm. Very elegant.
Yeah. Very elegant female. So I thought that was Gaiman all over that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if you haven't read any of the Sandmans. The Sandmans are very interesting.
Heather at Craftlit is always talking about them, and I haven't I've never really been into graphic novels.
Yeah, and nor have I. I haven't read very many, and I've got three of the Sandman is all I've read so far. They're worth reading.
Which one?
There's some deep stuff going on there. I just started the first one, but
okay. So I bet the library has them now.
Oh, I bet they do. In fact, yeah, the library I used to go to had them.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll look
up in Pocatello, Idaho.
Well, if they had it, surely the Dallas library has it.
Pocatello, Idaho has a surprisingly good science fiction section.
They must have had a very generous donor. I bet they have a great audiobook selection.
They No, that's Malad, Idaho. Malad's the one that got all my audio.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's funny. Right.
So we haven't mentioned two other characters. So you've got Aziraphale and Crowley floating around this book throughout all of human history. But then there's two other characters that I would call main characters. And one is named Newton Pulsifer. And then the descendant of Agnes Nutter, the witch.
Yeah.
And I don't have her name highlighted. Do you remember
her
name?
No, I can't remember it. Oh, my gosh. That's terrible.
Anathema. Anathema device.
Right, because I rather like the sound of the word. And you're just like, right.
Oh. I was like, it started with an A. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anathema device. Now, Agnes Nutter herself was pretty darn interesting.
Yeah.
She was a witch, and she really was a witch, and she wrote a book called The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter Witch. And I even love, you know, the play on words, because nice does not mean nice.
Yeah, people keep going, what's nice about him?
Yeah, no, exactly.
It used to mean precise.
Exactly. Exactly. And all the way through the book, there are little, you know, and there are footnotes all over that are so funny. And then they're always talking about, well, she predicted this and, you know, but her, you know, it's kind of like the Nostradamus thing, you know, where, you know, the stuff you read, you have no idea what it really says, because they said, well, she didn't understand what she was seeing. But they said basically that this really was accurate. And
yeah, I did love it because when they're making the point about how she was very accurate, but it was as if she had a telescope and she could just see a tiny bit of the future and she didn't understand it. And it said something like, beware of Betamax, Betamax.
That's funny. Yeah, and they said, you know, and on the day that Kennedy was assassinated, the prediction was that a house was going to fall down somewhere in England or something like that.
Because she was worried about her descendants. She wasn't worried about, you know, the bigger stuff, or she didn't know about it.
Yeah. That was funny.
She just took care of them, and they had spent their entire... Everybody in that family spent all their time trying to decipher what these things meant. And if you got it right, for example, one of Anathema's, you know, like her grandfather or uncle or somebody had been able to decipher 2 days before the market crash what it meant, taken a chance and made a fortune. So it could work out. But so Anathema knows that the end of time is coming because they're coming down to the end of the book and it's got her mentioned and all that kind of thing. And so she's trying to work things out. And then Newton, he works for the witch finder.
Right. So he's this hapless guy. Just, you know, that would be a terrific role to play in a movie. Mm-hmm. But he calls up this ad that says fight evil, you know? So he calls up this ad and he ends up working as a witch finder private. Yeah, his life hasn't gone very well up till now, but he's got this weird knack, you know, it's of fixing things. So
always doing the opposite of what anything really wants.
Yeah, exactly.
Mechanically, there was a magazine that sold kits of some kind of transistor or something, or a radio, and it said,
yes,
you'll put this together and you'll never be able to get it to work. He had to call them and complain because it worked
really good. Because it worked just fine for him, yeah.
Whereas when he'd put together the ones that, like, the computer kits and things, they would never work.
Yeah, I highlighted this thing just because it made me laugh. It says, Newt did, in fact, own a small home computer, despite his boyhood experiences. In fact, he'd owned several. You'd always know which ones he owned. They were the desktop equivalents of the Wasabi. They were the ones which, for example, dropped to half price right after he'd bought them, or were launched in a blaze of publicity and disappeared into obscurity within a year, or only worked at all if you stuck them in a fridge.
Yeah.
I love it. So, yeah. So he's that kind of fella. And, yeah, those two made a good pair. It was funny.
Mm-hmm.
Anathema device. So they're trying to decipher, you know, this apocalypse as well, and are also trying to stop it, which is fun.
Yeah, and I think I appreciated their parts more this time because I went ahead and listened to the audiobook, which is read by Martin Jarvis, who I'd never heard before, but oh my goodness, I'm going to look for him.
Oh, good.
He was superb.
Oh, that's great.
Especially when you've read a book as many times as I have, you kind of worry about, is the narrator's voice going to match what you imagine? And
for
the most part, unfortunately, the only one I felt he didn't really hit the way I would have was Adam. He kind of did him as a world-weary sort. And I thought, no, he's a fresh young kid, you know, a little more enthusiastic than that. But everything, it didn't ruin the book at all. And everybody, I mean, he hit them spot on. And because I was listening, I wasn't hustling along to my next favorite part, I could appreciate them more.
Oh, that's cool.
Those two characters, yeah. And the whole dash to the end where everybody's showing up at the disused aerodrome. And they do a lot of funny things, which is typical of both these authors, with mixing up two things that you'd never think about, such as an 11-year-old boy with the Antichrist powers of changing matter around him and a bunch of crank magazines that are talking about aliens landing everywhere and wishing us peace and the Tibetans tunneling and coming up all over the world and the Kraken, or was that the Kraken? Something rising from Atlantis, rising from the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
And so you've got these little vignettes through the book of the passenger ship going, well, is there Morse code for Atlantis has risen and the natives or the priests are playing shuffleboard with the, you know, the passengers of my ship, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's great. I just love British humor, just generally. And this is definitely it.
I know that was a note.
Go ahead. I was going to mention that.
They just said they had to explain the humor to the American publishers.
And I'm glad that they didn't Americanize it. You know, that's one of the things I was so annoyed about the Harry Potter, is that there was a British version and there was an American version. I was like, oh, come on.
I know.
I wonder if it would have made any difference to the popularity if they would kept.
No.
I mean, it was so minor, this stuff. Yeah. So
the Sorcerer's Stone versus the Philosopher's Stone.
Exactly. Why change it?
I know. That's, well, you know, marketers.
Yeah, I know it.
Oh, wait, that's me. Never mind.
Americans will never understand this.
No, I know.
Sherbet lemon. We don't want sherbet lemon. We want something else.
Yeah. Why make kids just read for context, which they would do anyway, and then they'd be broadened a bit. They'd figure it out. Yeah.
And then someone would be selling sherbet lemon in the United States.
That's right. That's right. Well, I did love the point that this is a toss-off line where it says, it is said that hell has the best tunes. This is broadly true. It says, but heaven has the best choreographers. Like, this is true. And I'm like, that is actually such a perfect... That statement could sum up not only the book, but most of our lives, right?
Yeah.
You know, hell has the best tunes and they sound good and you want to dance and you want to do all this stuff. But Heaven's got the best choreographers. That's the Lord of the Rings thing where it's like, oh, you guys made the wrong choice. All right. You're not going to enjoy it, but we can get back on track. You know, the luck thing.
Exactly. Wow.
I'll have you guys picked up by orcs and marched to where you need to be.
Wow. Profound stuff.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, both these guys, I think, are atheists or agnostic as far as I know. And they're, I think when I was reading it, I was thinking about the authors because although they were being funny, they were making a lot of points about human beings and expectations and what we intentions and what we do to ourselves. And I was thinking, I think you would describe them as humanists, maybe.
Yeah, probably.
As much as I understand that, which I don't understand very well.
Yeah, I mean.
Which is humans are basically good and we can do things.
Sure. Yeah. You know,
is that it? Is that
well, yeah, that's what I would say that these guys are. Right. I don't know if humanism can be defined as that all the time, but it's okay, like, you know, Joss Whedon's brand of humanism.
Right.
Is an optimistic humanism where you are a fan of humanity and you do believe that, you know, I remember Joss Whedon saying, despite the evidence, we believe that, you know, humans can be really good, you know, so. But yeah, I believe that these two are both from the same kind of a fold.
And that's in a sense, that's the message you get, except for the fact, and I think because the way they'd written the book, they couldn't leave this out, but Aziraphale makes the point to everybody at the end. And this is, you know, one of those save the day points in the book is, well, you guys think you have to have Armageddon, but do you, is that really the plan? Mm-hmm. Well, otherwise, why would we have done this? Well, it's ineffable, isn't it? That means it's bigger than we can think and we can't describe it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all these things are essentially put down to not only human effort making them happen, but the ineffable plan.
Right.
That's what makes everyone, the supernatural powers of good and evil that want to have this battle, they are ready. And in that sense, at that point, they're the same side. Both of them want to destroy the Earth. To settle this question of good and evil.
Yeah.
And Aziraphale's point is, you are both acting the same way, and God's plan is ineffable, so maybe this is not what he wants.
That's right. That's right. And that was interesting at the end. You know, you had representatives of both sides, one of the higher ups, mm-hmm. both present, listening, and they both went off to talk to the people in charge or the being in charge. Check. Exactly.
Well, and it's that also they make the point on a smaller level when they're, one of my favorite conversations always is when they're talking about, they better check with their sources, Crowley and Aziraphale
mm-hmm.
on trying to find, how do we find the Antichrist? Cause now we know it's not this kid. He's somewhere. Where is he? How do we find him? And Crowley says, well, I'll check with the terrorists and see. And he goes, well, I guess you don't have people like that. And he goes, oh, well, yeah. So of course we call them freedom fighters, says Aziraphale. It's like right. They're doing the exact same thing, but it's a different intention.
Right. Different perspective. Depends on what side you're on, right?
Yeah. And so it gets muddled.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And you said, you know, you were saying something about they've talked about a movie before, because I could see this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, at the end of the last podcast, I looked it up on IMDb and it said that it existed as a project. And then here on Wikipedia, it says that the film very nearly happened in 2002. And it was going to be directed by Terry Gilliam. It says, as of 2002, Terry Gilliam still hoped to make the film with its already completed script, but by 2006 it seemed to have come to nothing. Funding was slow to appear, and Gilliam moved on to other projects.
Okay.
And then it says here, there was a rumor that Johnny Depp was originally cast as Crowley and Robin Williams as Aziraphale.
And I could see instantly Johnny Depp would be a wonderful Crowley.
Mm-hmm.
And Robin Williams, you made the point when you were mentioning this earlier, Terry Gilliam did direct him in The Fisher King, and he was good in that, because I think he's one of those people who needs a director who knows how to rein him in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sure. I can't remember who that director is who works with Jack Black. He did Bernie, and he did School of Rock.
Oh, yeah.
And in those, he gave very good performances that were what the movie needed, different sorts of performances. Mm-hmm. And Robin Williams is that sort. If you just let him run, he's too much. But
right,
yeah, he could be a good Aziraphale, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see him in that role. That's not who I thought of. But the person in my mind's eye was Frasier's brother.
Who would be perfect?
Yeah. What is his name? Darn it.
He's such a great actor too.
Yeah,
David
he is.
Hyde Pierce.
That's him. Yeah, I think he would be perfect for Aziraphale.
I apologize for this dog barking.
No, don't worry.
I don't know what's going on, but something alarming, evidently.
It could be the apocalypse. You might want to.
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, maybe she's a little hellhound. She is kind of scruffy looking like that. She, in fact, her personality is a little bit that of a hellhound.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, he would be good.
But yeah, that would be fun. I mean,
that's
if he
the
was
sort
there.
Of character. Because that was one of my favorite bits was when they run into Crowley and Aziraphale are going through the countryside in the dark, trying to get to find out what happened, why the Antichrist isn't who they think he is. And they run into Anathema on her bicycle and it's all crumpled up. And so Aziraphale fixes it by magic. It's his good deed. And she keeps going, I don't think this is my bicycle. It's got a bicycle pump. And he's like, well, there were hooks there. I know, but the pump was lost a long time ago. And she's looking at it going, pretty sure it didn't have this little repair kit with tartan bows. And Crowley's thinking, yes, his fashion sense was stuck in the 50s. Tartan, very smart.
Oh, that's really something. Oh, what a fun book. Really made me laugh.
Yes, I'm so glad you picked it. I just love
this
book.
Thank you. Thanks for reading it again.
Oh.
Yeah.
My
so
pleasure.
Fun. So fun.
Love it.
Now, I had a you've been talking a lot about, before we leave, about Noah, the movie, on your blog. You haven't quite seen it yet? I was just curious. Yeah.
No, we were going to see it because we will see it. I'm a fan of, you know, old style biblical movies and, you know, the Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was so thrilled, like, oh, somebody's doing one of those. And then I looked at it and went, Darren Aronofsky is directing it. I've never seen any of his movies. They're always very dark, like The Wrestler and The Black Swan. And Rose has told me all about them.
I've seen The Black Swan. I've wonderful. Never seen The Wrestler.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understand it was wonderful. It just, you know, somebody would have to pick it and I'd watch it and then it would be my new favorite movie. I know how this works. But I'm not attracted to it. But then a while back, I just vaguely became aware of this controversy in the Christian community. And I just thought, oh, really, guys, do you have to make us all look stupid? You know, thank you for nothing. Because everybody was worried. Somebody, a Christian screenwriter, had gotten a hold of an early draft of the script that was very pro-environmentalism and pro-population control. And it's kind of like, I don't even want to go into why, you know, all these things, but basically this set a lot of people off and not God, not mentioned and, or his name never said or something like that. And, so interestingly, Stephen Gray Danis, is that how you say his name?
Yeah, I think so.
He's really, really well-respected film critic, but he's Catholic. And I say, but he's Catholic. So to me, that gives him a little more interest in it from that point of view, but he's really well respected by all kinds of film critics. No matter what, they'll refer to him a lot. And he got interested because he was like, would everybody just calm down? We haven't seen the final product. And when you're complaining about how it's going to be interpreted, it won't be interpreted like we think. Think about what you're thinking of. The animals went in two by two. Here's Noah and his wife in the ark. Go read it. It's not exactly like we remember. And so he was saying he thought it was kind of like Midrash, you know, that rabbinical thing of taking a piece of scripture and looking for the underlying meanings that aren't just spelled out by telling their own little parables or stories or fleshing it out in a different way. So you can just think about the text more. And he said, it's likely to be more like that. And this is a very interesting director. And he's been thinking about this story for 17 years or 14 years.
Oh, wow.
Ever since in the seventh grade, he wrote an essay about the dove in Noah and something. And he won a contest and he went and read it at the UN.
Oh, wow.
And he's been immersed in the story and all the fables from there, or myths, I guess they aren't fables, myths from all the cultures of the flood at the time. And so they, the director and the writer, read Stephen Gray Danis's thoughts on this, and he got to interview them. And the first thing they said was, "We loved your piece. You get it." And he was like, "Oh, really?" So it was interesting to read the interview, because I don't really care about interviews, but I read that one. And then I did read his review, because I was like, I'm worried about spoilers. And Tom says, "I don't want to ruin it for you, but there's a dove and a rainbow somewhere in the end." I was like, "Oh,
no."
So so I started off to write a short introduction on my blog, Happy Catholic, about, okay, let's just kind of take a little step back and look at it. It wound up being more than I thought when I got into it, of course, blah, 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 like this is right now. But I linked to those, and then I've updated it since then, because another major Christian person who Brandywine Books had mentioned — I love Brandywine Books, they review all these books, thrillers and mysteries and everything, and I think they're Lutheran. And they had recommended this guy who'd been asked, because the movie studio is like, man, we got to handle the Christians now. So they'd asked a bunch of Christian influential people to come and watch the movie and talk with the director. And he kind of came to the same conclusion. He had, you know, they all keep going, okay, there's a few theological things I wish had been handled differently, but it's a movie. Mm-hmm. They get all these things right. And they said, this movie isn't for everyone, because not every movie is for everyone.
Sure.
And they said, but it's such a fascinating look at how you look at this story. How do we relate to God? How does God relate to us? How do we relate to each other? I mean, it's all those questions that we are all always struggling with on some level. And he recommended it. And then since then, Stephen Gray Danis has written his review, which I haven't read because I do want to wait to watch the movie. And he's also written a question and answer on a zillion questions he's been asked in comments boxes. Things like, where is it the same as the Noah story? Where is it different than the Noah story? And I printed it out, but again, I haven't read it, because I'm like, I would rather get that view myself.
Yeah, sure.
And then go read those things and see. But I'm really interested in it anyway.
Yeah, I'm as well. I'm interested as well. So I will go see that soon.
Yeah, and I kind of turned out, in my own personal circle, I wound up being kind of like Stephen Gray Danis, who wrote the thing about, just, could we just chill out? Because over the weekend, I was at this workshop in San Antonio with a zillion different Catholics, and the movie would come up, and they'd all go, I hear they never use the word God. Tom was there, and he goes, well, the Jews don't say the name of God, right? Isn't that a thing? I mean, you know, and everybody went, oh, yeah.
That is a thing, yeah. I wish people would calm down. I think that's good advice just generally. I know. Can we just calm down?
I know. Well, so I wound up kind of just presenting some of these concepts, and I turned myself into a defender of the movie, not having seen it, but just going, this is that knee-jerk reaction. And I saw somebody else saying, in relation to this movie, they were talking about it more simply, but they said, why is the first reaction of a lot of Christians when they hear about something like this to turn and run away and complain and cry? They said, is this what the Old Testament figures would have done? Abraham, you know, Jacob, King David. How about Christ? Did they go, oh, no, I don't like it, and go run away? No, they just went, I'm here in the culture. I'm going to stick up for what I believe, and I can't know what I believe unless I'm part of it.
Right, right.
See it or learn more about it, or, you know, you don't have to see it, but at least get informed.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I felt the same way about a lot of the Harry Potter talk, you know, bringing Harry Potter up again.
Yeah.
But that was one of the most Christian novels I think I've ever read. Yes. I mean, that whole series. I mean, it was profound. Yeah. It was profound, you know, and
yeah.
Whether, you know, I have no idea how Rowling feels about that at all, but
she said it was intentional.
Yeah. So there we go. So, but why on earth? I don't like this, you know, there's way too much, not only in literature and movies and things, but just this hearsay, this thing gets around, and now everybody, now this is fact. And, you know, I've learned a long time ago, especially, I think that the prime example of it in our times is the Pope, you know, not only Pope Francis, but Pope Benedict, Pope John Paul II. Mm-hmm. I have learned that if it's in the news, I've got to go find out what's really going on because it is just like hearsay or whatever. And, you know, the it's almost never right.
Yeah, it's one little soundbite, and it's essentially, I guess, it's the same problem that there is with gossiping.
Yeah, and that's you're what it really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although you're gossiping about like a piece of work rather than a person, which is, you know, I guess better. But, you know, when you are gossiping about a person, that's not good. You shouldn't be doing that.
That's the thing. I mean, because I didn't read the Dan Brown book, The Da Vinci Code, but you did, right?
I did, yeah.
So when people were arguing about that and talking about it and, you know, basing everything off of a movie and five sound bites or, you know, reading this book, and suddenly they're experts about the Catholic Church and it was a work of fiction, you just go, wait, look into the things that are being talked about here.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, you can say what you want about the Da Vinci Code, but the discussion about the Catholic Church that occurred around that book, we should be thanking Dan Brown for that. Because you're saying, well, this thing that he's talking about is incorrect, and this is why we believe that. And that was everywhere. So thanks, Dan Brown. Yeah.
Yeah, well, because I had people coming to me saying, do you know a good book I could read about this? Because these people in my office are quoting it as factual. And I would really like, do you have some articles or something? And these are people who would never normally do that, but they got so tired of hearing bashing going on.
Yeah.
I mean, not even really not Catholic people that they were saying, I need some defense. And I'm like, when are you going to find the church defended like that?
And this is the urge to stand up and defend that. And it was all, you know, it was just a work of art, you know, where this guy was doing his thing. And there was a lot of really interesting things in there that I would say would have interested the people in the Catholic Church, you know, not specifically the philosophy. But all of the art and the beautiful stuff that they were, you know, even Angels and Demons, which I think is a book I like a little bit better. All the places that they went there, it makes you want to go over there and see these places, you know. And you're like, okay, well, who built these things? Well, you know, these were Catholics, and this is tradition, and this is how we've expressed these ineffable things, right?
Yeah.
So, right. You know, in that way, you know, the Dan Brown books were excellent.
Well, you know? Yeah, because that's like what we do here, where it's not specifically Christian, or where sometimes it might have elements that are very anti-Christian. But
sure.
The work itself, what is it saying as a whole? And that still opens the door for discussion on other levels.
Yeah, no. Exactly. And that's what that Midrash you're talking about does as well.
Right. And that's the whole Noah thing is when are you going to get this many people talking about just this story in general? Because the point I was making to somebody was, okay, they may not say the name of God, but I believe God speaks to Noah. So you don't have to have the name, right? Yeah, I think he calls him Lord. I'm good with that.
Yeah.
You know?
That's interesting. And the whole concept of being angry about something that I've never seen is something that it's just pointless to participate in. And, you know, whether it be politics or artworks, you know, or anything like that, it's like, you know, go see the movie and then you can go ahead and have all the angst you want.
Yeah. Well, or even if you don't want to go see the movie, at least get several informed looks at it.
Sure. Another example of this was Philip Pullman.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he wrote some atheistic, you know, that's what they call atheistic, The Golden Compass, right?
Right, that's it.
Now, I saw the film The Golden Compass, and I didn't like it very much. But it had nothing to do
with... most people didn't.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with atheism. But the image that I had in my mind of Philip Pullman and what his purpose was cemented in my mind from other people, not having read The Golden Compass itself. Mm-hmm. Then I heard an interview of him on Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, and it seemed to me that the guys on Geek's Guide were trying to pull this atheism out of him, because they often, you know, throw atheistic things out there and say, you know, aren't church people dumb? I'm talking
it's
about
popular in science fiction.
Yeah, I'm talking about the books. Yeah, the hosts of that show.
Yeah.
Who I like very much. I like John Joseph Adams very much. But anyway, it was like they were saying, you know, oh boy, you know, this guy's going to have some cool things to say.
We can get together and have a great time.
And Philip Pullman would have none of it.
Really?
He was talking very respectfully about Jesus and about the Bible. But not from a believer standpoint, but a respectful standpoint.
Well, that's nice.
I was really surprised. And I was like, you know, and then I realized my whole image of Philip Pullman had come from other people telling me what was wrong with him.
And Christians going.
Exactly. Yeah. It doesn't mean that his book, The Golden Compass, is not atheistic. And really, it's not, you know, the movie anyway. Was not so much atheistic as anti-religious. It was like, you know, the Catholic Church as an entity
is not portrayed well.
Yeah, was the model of this religious persecution that was going on in the book. So,
yeah,
that was going on in the movie. I haven't read the book.
Yeah, my mother loved the book. Uh-huh. Several people I knew loved the book and recommended it, and I'd heard all the, you know, atheistic stuff, and I'm like, well, okay, I'll try it, though. All these other people like it. And I got about halfway through and just went, yeah, it's not grabbing me. I just, it wasn't anything to do with anything, except I was just like, I just don't care. It never engaged me. But it was interesting because there was a friend of Hannah's who he's kind of, we call him our unofficially adopted son. We just love this guy. Mm-hmm. And he said that he loved these books and he'd given them to his young, I think, nieces and nephews or cousins or something. And then he said, whatever the end of the series is, whether it's three books or five books or whatever. And he goes, because it was so great. He goes, and then I read the last book and went, oh no. He goes, and it was so anti-religious. It was so obvious. And I had fed this to these kids and he was horrified. And he himself is not that religious. And I was like, but he's religious enough, I guess. And, I was like, well, then I guess that's the chance for you to talk to them about the whole idea, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's
just because
that's
it's
a
in
really
the book, do you have to believe
point.
That?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point.
Think about what you're reading.
I think that when someone's presented with that kind of a book and you look at it and you look around and you say, well, you know, the church doesn't really seem to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, it is a work of fiction. It doesn't say the Catholic Church in there.
But
that's
why discussion is so important, because if to take this example of this boys, if those kids read that and they like it, they kind of absorb those ideas. That's kind of the point of reading a book. You know, you kind of what do I like and what do I not? But if you have the discussion with the person who gave you the books and they go, wasn't the story great, but think about it. What are they telling? What does this mean? You can later make up your own mind about it, but you have to have a guide sometimes, you know,
sometimes
to kind of help you know what else is going on in there.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with that. That's
kind
of what we do here, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I was going to say that's kind of why we do this. And you're going to be doing having a movie group with Gravity, right?
Yeah. We're going to show Gravity and talk about Gravity with the Newman Center folks.
Yeah, which will be...
That'll be fun.
So fun.
That'll be enjoyable, yeah.
But it's that same kind of thing is... so if that happens, and then you talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of helps, too, if there are good things and bad things. There are good and bad things in life.
Yeah,
those things aren't black and white.
Yeah. There are good and bad things in our church. It's unfortunate, but it's absolutely true, and we can't ignore them.
Yeah, exactly.
We can say this is wrong and this is the way it should be, which is what we should be doing, you know, always improving, right?
Well, and I guess it kind of comes down to, in a sense, there's two ways of looking at something. And this is really simplifying, but I had this quote on my blog yesterday, so I was thinking about it, where it was somebody from Goodreads named Alex. Let's see if I can find it really quick. I have my quote journal here. And he had just finished reading H.P. Lovecraft. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I find Lovecraft's general paranoia a bit hard to empathize with. I tend to think of the world as being ruled mostly by benign incompetence rather than malicious conspiracy." And that's kind of the perfect summing up for Good Omens, or, you know, this thing I saw at this workshop I was at, where it was all the people who'd been leading these marriage retreats. And they're trying to just hash out where they're going. And the more I looked at how many different ideas there were and how people were struggling with communicating, and I looked at it and thought of the church as a whole, and I said, you know, people who think the Catholic Church is a huge conspiracy should look at this and go, we're really muddling along, okay? You know, we've got our basic tenets of exactly where we are. That's solid. But we are people. Right. And a lot of times we're just doing the best we can, man. Very much like Good Omens.
Oh, that is cool. Very nice quote. I love it. Yeah. Well, nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we should probably wrap this up.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, we've talked forever.
But it was interesting.
I liked it, of course.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. All right. Next up is a movie, Shower.
Oh, yeah.
Chinese movie.
Yeah, that'll fantastic. Be fun.
That'll be a lot of fun. And then The Rosie Project.
Mm-hmm.
By Graham Simsion.
Simsion, I think, Simsion. Is how you say it. That's easy to find everywhere, and it's a quick, easy read.
You bet. And then Jesus, A Pilgrimage by James Martin, which I have started and am enjoying very much.
Oh, good.
Yep, very much.
Well, since you picked it, I guess I'm acting like I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. Oh, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that James Martin wrote a book on humor. What was that called again?
Oh, gosh. Something about mirth.
Yeah. Between Heaven and Mirth.
That's it.
Yep. By James Martin. Talks about humor and the church. And
yeah.
And anyway.
And how laughter and joy and all that stuff are definitely part of everything. That was a good book. I read it.
You bet.
Reviewed it. Yeah.
In fact, you sent it to me. I have it.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Thank you very much.
I think I gave my copy out. Okay.
You gave it to me. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Great. All right. Well, everybody have a wonderful 2 weeks.
Yes. Yes. And we gave you plenty to listen to for a while.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks again, Julie.
Oh, thank you, Scott.
Yes.
And thanks to everybody out there listening. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.